Blog Talk Radio.
In 1999, under a veil of enormous secrecy and a staggering 12 years after his previous picture, Full Metal Jacket, director Stanley Kubrick completed post-production on what was to be his final film. Eyes Wide Shut arrived in multiplexes, having only been whispered and speculated about during an unprecedented two-year production. Will this be the sexiest movie ever made? A non-stop, no-holds-barred orgy featuring none other than the power couple of Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman? Adding further to the film's anticipation was Kubrick's unfortunate death 4 days after screening his first cut of the film for Warner Brothers studio heads and his two lead actors. Cinephiles wondered whether or not Kubrick's vision could ultimately suffer from unauthorized tampering following his death. Tonight, we celebrate one of our most legendary directors and what was to be his most mysterious, controversial, and sadly, his final film, Stanley Kubrick and Eyes Wide Shut, next on Movie Geeks United.
Tonight, the Movie Geeks celebrate the genius of director Stanley Kubrick and look back at Kubrick's final film, Eyes Wide Shut. First up, she played the mysterious character Mandy opposite Tom Cruise and Sidney Pollack. Actress Julianne Davis. Then, he worked behind the scenes on Barry Lyndon and The Shining, and worked side-by-side with Kubrick as the cinematographer of Eyes Wide Shut, Larry Smith. Got a question for the geeks or any of tonight's guests? Give us a call at 718-508-9477, or visit the chat room on our Blog Talk Radio page now. Dim the lights, grab the popcorn, and get ready to get your geek on. Here are your hosts for Movie Geeks United, Jamie, Chris, and Jerry.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United, a great Sunday night program we have for you tonight, celebrating the work of Stanley Kubrick and his final film, Eyes Wide Shut, in particular. My name is Jamie. I'm one of your co-hosts for the evening. Let me introduce our other co-hosts. We have Chris. Hey, Chris.
Howdy.
And Jerry's right here as well.
Hey, what's up?
And we also have our home entertainment guru, because we're crafting this show in conjunction with Tuesday's release of the Warner Brothers Special Edition 5-DVD box set of some of Stanley Kubrick's greatest work. Say hello to Aaron. Hey, Aaron.
Hey, what's up, guys?
We're very, very excited to bring this show to you tonight, and an honor to be able to speak to the talent we're speaking to this evening. A couple of notes. You can subscribe to our show through iTunes. Just click on the Subscribe to iTunes icon on the Blog Talk Radio page, or just search us, look for us in the engine, the search engine of the iTunes program, just Movie Geeks United. All of our past shows will show up. We've had some great past shows. Like Jerry, tell them some of the shows that we've had.
Well, the last show we had was on with Michael Berryman of The Hills Have Eyes.
Perfect for Halloween.
Incredible show. We went actually a little over with him, but it was worth it. I mean, he's definitely one of the icons. I mean, he's a very scary presence in The Hills Have Eyes, and he's probably one of the nicest guests that we've had.
Very much, and we spent a lot of time talking about One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yes, no, that's good, but we also had, a couple weeks ago, we had John Badham.
Yes.
And that was an incredible show, and we also had Crystal Lowe from Wrong Turn 2, which was incredible. Before that, though, we actually had a very interesting show. We had Garrett Dillahunt from Jesse James, but also from the forthcoming Coen Brothers film, No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
I mean, we are really in the moment every week. We really take you to the heart and center and core of what's going on in movies in 2007.
That's
and in
right.
2008, we will take you even further.
That's right. Hear, hear. Thank you. And like people like Joey Pants and Howard Shore, Oscar winners, man.
Oh, I mean, the Howard Shore show was incredible.
All right. Well, welcome everyone to the show. If you have any questions for any of our guests, our chat room is open. We'll be monitoring it throughout the show. You can also call into our show, 718-508-9477. Let's get this thing started. Aaron's going to give you a little primer on the box set a little later on in the show, so you guys know what to expect. But first, here's a little primer on the story behind Eyes Wide Shut. Kubrick first thought of adapting Arthur Schnitzler's 1925 story, Traum Nouvelle, as far back as 1968, right after completing principal photography on 2001. The American translation of Traum Nouvelle is actually Dream Story, which could go a long way towards decrypting this challenging, powerful movie. Schnitzler, it's interesting, I read today, he was always coined a Freudian writer, and in fact Freud claimed that he was frightened of meeting Schnitzler because he felt like he would be meeting his double. Kubrick ultimately took the story, renamed it Eyes Wide Shut, and modernized it in a New York setting to tell the story of a couple who undergo a dramatic transformation fueled by sexual obsession and jealousy. After his wife Alice discloses a long-held but never acted-upon sexual fantasy involving another man, Bill Hartford journeys out into the Manhattan night, ravaged and tortured by jealousy, and finds himself in a sexual underworld that may or may not place him in a situation of great danger. The idea for Eyes Wide Shut rested in the back of Kubrick's mind for almost 30 years. Partly, he was waiting for a period of time when he and his wife felt emotionally ready to immerse themselves in the process of bringing this material to life. Kubrick circled creative talents like Steve Martin and Woody Allen for roles in the film before deciding upon Tom Cruise, Nicole Kidman, and Sidney Pollack as his lead performers. Actors Harvey Keitel and Jennifer Jason Leigh were also involved, but they were replaced when they could not attend reshoots because this was one of the longest shoots in the history of movies, as it was reported. Our first guest tonight, Julian Davis, played the pivotal role of Amanda Curran in Eyes Wide Shut, a character who acts as the catalyst for the fear and paranoia that grip Bill Hartford as he tries to make sense of his brief but life-altering journey. Miss Davis made her feature film debut in Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut, and that's a great way to start off a career, guys. In addition to feature roles in other TV series and films like House of Nine, she is the writer, co-producer, and lead singer of a fantastic band by the name of Sophisticated Savage, and it is great music. It's a great pleasure to welcome to our show Miss Julian Davis. Miss Davis, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you. Gosh, that's quite an introduction. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for being with us. We're honored to have you on here.
No, it's a pleasure. I'm just glad you got your intellectuals rather than saying, you know, the typical thing, ooh, what was it like working with Stanley? Not sort of asking a specific question, because I know that you guys are going to be asking some very great questions.
Oh, wow. Don't say that before I start my question. tell me a little bit about yourself before we get in Eyes Wide Shut. Had you been doing theater or other performance work prior to the opportunity for Eyes Wide Shut?
No, quite frankly, I dabbled in acting years before in America and pretty much gave up on it and became a model because that was making me really good money. I then moved to New York and then moved to London. And when this thing came up, I actually auditioned for an extra role in Eyes Wide Shut, and I auditioned for Leon Vitali, Stanley's right-hand man. And Stanley saw me on tape, called me in to meet him. I then had three screen tests and got the part.
Oh, wow.
It was really that, it was just, it was a bizarre thing to have happen, but it was lucky. You know, good thing for a first film.
I would absolutely think so, yeah. Now, when did you first meet Kubrick? Was it once you got the job?
Oh, no. I'd already been in Britain for a few years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you had to have had some expectations of what he was like. Did he meet those expectations, or did he surprise
you?
Well,
you know, I'd heard some things about him being difficult and all that stuff, and but at the same time, I was fascinated by him. I was, you know, some of the films, Lolita, Dr. Strangelove, two of my all-time favorites, 2001. In fact, I think that was one thing that really fascinated him about me because my father worked for Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is an offshoot of NASA. And I remember my father saying he was impressed with Stanley's observation that in 2001 there was no sound except for the person breathing into their mask or whatever, you know, when they were outside the spaceship.
Yeah.
And Stanley's one of the few directors that caught on that because in space, if there's no atmosphere, there's no way for sound to travel.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would have total silence. And he was impressed that, you know, I didn't come from stupid stock, basically.
Well,
I think that helped.
He was extremely well-read and well-versed on such a variety of things. I mean, he had an endless curiosity, it seemed.
He was a huge intellectual.
Yeah.
Huge. And, in fact, I would go so far as to say he lived, I mean, a lot of people thought he was strange in that respect. Because, you know, he'd walk on set and every day he wore the exact same clothes.
Mm-hmm.
He probably had 10 pairs of all the same things, you know.
Yeah.
And I think it's because he just didn't, he lived his entire life in his head. You know, he didn't care about the outer things when it came to himself personally. He was a total intellectual in that way. And so, and I think the reason why he had the same outfits on, it's because, you know, he didn't want to have to think about that. He had too many other things that he would prefer to think about.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely true. And I know that this was an extremely long shoot, but how far into shooting?
Long and lucrative for me, so I didn't complain.
How far into the shooting did you come on, and how long were you actually involved in the production?
Well, I think they pretty much, with the exception of a few weeks here and a few weeks there, I think, from memory, it was about 8 months I was on that shoot.
Oh, wow.
I know.
That's a long time.
Yeah. I know. But the thing is that much of that time was they were just paying me to be around, you know.
To be available.
And there were some days that I would show up on set, and I would just sit there and wait and wait and wait and wait. And sometimes days would go by and I wouldn't be on set because they just didn't get to it yet.
Yeah.
And, you know, he'd take so much time getting the lighting exactly right. I mean, he took a week or 10 days just to light the first scene in the bathroom.
Oh.
That first scene with Sydney and Tom and me.
Wow.
And just absolutely meticulous about it.
Yeah, I just recently heard an interview with Sidney Pollack where he said that Kubrick would walk on set and say, something's wrong with the lighting, and Larry Smith would say, there's nothing wrong with it. And eventually he investigated, and it was off by something like an eighth of a stop, and he knew it just by walking on. Yeah, he could
feel
it.
I know. I have to say, Stanley was a complete control freak in that respect. You know, he needed it to be absolutely perfect. Yeah. And the people that he surrounded himself with were all people of greatness, because he just wouldn't allow for things not to be perfect.
Yeah. Well, did he, at least in terms of performance, did he allow for spontaneity? I know you hear about all...
Absolutely.
All, yeah.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, the first scene, well, not the first scene where I'm completely out of it, but then the other scene where I'm in a towel, thankfully, which is the only scene that's on my showreel. that scene, you know, we completely, Sydney and Tom and me completely rewrote the thing. It was really funny. Yeah, we were all sitting there with the script girl, you know, scribbling out lines and, you know, scratching in other ones. And, you know, Sydney would walk up and say, now, you know, I wouldn't just say that. I would say this. And then I would say, oh, well, you know, if Sydney's going to say this, then I really should be doing this. And then Tom would say, oh, okay, well, then if you guys are doing that, then I'll do this. And, you know, so the whole thing went like that. And Stanley was completely open-minded to that. You know, as long as it worked, this is the thing. The important thing with Stanley is he just wanted it to be the best it could be. And, you know, obviously, if we put forward an opinion that wasn't right, he would nix it.
Yeah.
Immediately, you know. So, but, you know, we had good ideas, and he liked those ideas. And, you know, but he'd also ask, you know, when we'd finish a scene, we'd all look at it on the monitor, and he would look at Tom and me and Sydney, and he goes, yeah, I think that one's pretty good. Let's go with that. And then Tom would look at him and go, let's just do it one more time.
Oh, wow. Tom actually requested.
It wasn't just Stanley. It was Tom as well wanting to do things again and again.
Oh, well, I always thought that Tom Cruise and Kubrick were the perfect match creatively, because Tom Cruise is so driven to get it just right. I mean, he's unstoppable.
Yes, I agree. And in fact, before then, you know, I used to think of Tom Cruise as just somebody who, you know, was a kind of sellout actor because he did all the big films like Mission Impossible and stuff
right.
like that. And after working with Tom, I have to say, I have the greatest respect for him as an actor. Mm. He's not a prima donna at all, not like what you hear. He's just a lovely guy, and he gives 100%. And 100%, even when the camera is not on him, in order for the performance to be great either way.
He acts across from you off camera.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh, no, none of this dub stand-in business.
Yeah, that's
you
great.
You know, guy is a very hard worker and gives it his all. Because he wanted the project to be great, and he believed in the project, had total faith in it, and such a positive guy, such a professional. I'm very impressed with Tom. I think he's a great guy, great actor.
Yeah, we all agree here. But it sounds like there wasn't necessarily rehearsal. The rehearsal, if you will, probably took place during the shooting phase.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we rehearsed while we were there. Absolutely.
Yeah. And what a unique position that Kubrick was in when he was able to make films for Warner Brothers, and that he had the benefit of and the luxury of time, more so than any director.
Stanley had total and absolute say.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't matter. Whatever he asked for, he received. I mean, there was no question, you know.
Yeah.
And Warner Brothers just carte blanche, absolutely.
I want to ask you two things that got some press during the production phase of it and the post-production phase of it.
Okay.
Now, were you working with Sidney Pollack in that role from the beginning? Was Harvey Keitel originally cast in that role or not?
You know, I had heard that, but they didn't get to that scene at the time. I mean, Harvey Keitel was in some of the other scenes, but by the time they got to that scene, with me. I think they were looking at another girl, or they were looking at a few girls, but quite frankly, and I can understand this, there's a lot of girls that just didn't want to do the full frontal nudity.
Yeah.
You know? And it was a struggle for me as well. I mean, it's not something, you know, can I just say I'm not that kind of girl? So it's not something that I would, you know, that I would just run into and say, yeah, no problem.
Yeah.
I had to think about it. But, you know, you're... when you have a chance at your first films working with someone like Kubrick and you're acting along Tom Cruise, I mean, it's very difficult to turn something like that down.
That's
so
right.
I've heard, and this is only through the grapevine, like you guys have probably heard, that they were looking at some really big top models for this, things like that. And,
right.
You know, I was just a kind of, I was a working model, full-time working model when I went up for the role. But so I don't know. I mean, I honestly, you know, I don't know who else they looked at and who else for the part. You probably know more than I do. Yeah.
And there seemed to be a mystery, even though it's pretty clear to me when I watch the movie, but there seems to be a mystery surrounding whether or not you were the mystery girl at the party.
Yes. Yeah, that's a bit tricky. I was injured. During those initial scenes where we're all in a circle.
Uh-huh.
And so there was a girl that was acting as body double during some of those scenes. And quite frankly, I can't tell which one's me and which one's her because we looked pretty identical when we were standing up and walking. So,
right.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird because I'm looking at the thing, is that me or is that Abigail? And yeah, I can't quite tell. But, you know, I mean, we're wearing a mask. And she's got my hair, so
yeah.
It's pretty difficult to tell.
Now, did
I'm
you
just
see?
Glad I was, I'm just glad I was in the scenes where you do see my face, so I wasn't just a body.
Well, in those scenes with the mask, because there's such a disconnect between, once the mask is on, there's a disconnect between you, the physical appearance, and the voice. So I'm curious, when the mask is on, and we couldn't, and you, obviously we can't tell if it's you or the other girl, was that, did a case of dubbing come in, of like voice dubbing? Because
absolutely, because the other girl is English and can't do an American
okay.
accent.
Wow.
And I'm a voiceover artist as well, so I can change my voice to whatever I need to change it to.
Yeah.
You know.
Now, did you see the unrated, I know the unrated version played overseas, I believe. Did you see that version, and was there a substantial difference between that version and what we have here in the States?
You know, it was a bit more salacious. Sure.
Yeah.
It was. Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
but, you know, in America, they're a little bit more prudish when it comes to sexuality. Whereas,
we've always been
in,
prudish, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they don't mind seeing, you know, heads being blown off and blood spurting out everywhere, but you show sex and, oh, dear, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, it's insane. But that unrated version is available. It, for the first time, I believe, it's released as part of the DVD box set on Tuesday.
You know, the funny thing is, I don't think that really, quite frankly, I don't think it really adds or takes away from the film. I think, you know, the American version, the story comes across,
mm-hmm.
and I think the European version was just a little bit more salacious, but quite frankly, I don't know if it was any more necessary. I mean, the point had come across anyway.
Right.
Yeah, I think you're right, it didn't affect anything in terms of content. And
absolutely not. And
yeah,
in fact,
and it was
when,
just
you know,
part of that one scene, correct?
Well, and also when you think about the, well, I mean, everybody gets something different from a film like Kubrick because he always causes you to think.
Right.
You know, he doesn't spell everything out for you. But I think, you know, with that film, the message is still very clear. you know, whether it was the European version or the American version. I mean, that aspect of the story doesn't have anything to do, as far as I'm concerned, with the original message that he was trying to get across.
Yeah. So what was your opinion of it when you first saw it?
When I first saw it, it was at the premiere in Los Angeles, in Westwood. And, you know, so that was the first time. And I just remember when my first scene came on with me, you know, passed out in the chair fully naked. And the whole audience just went, like this.
Oh,
it was
wow.
A bit nerve-wracking, you know, and I've never seen myself on a big screen like that. You know, okay, the odd poster or something around town or TV commercial, but not anything like that before. So that was I don't know. I was sort of speechless, really.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I remember grabbing my husband's hand and squeezing quite tightly, like, oh, my God, oh, my God. One of those, yeah.
It's interesting because Kubrick films, they can't be fully appreciated just through one viewing.
And you know what? I agree with you entirely. In fact, the first time I saw it, I hadn't quite unlocked it.
Yeah.
It was the second time I saw it that I said, at home on DVD, and I was watching it again. I think I needed to watch it because I was putting together my show reel.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, in fact, I didn't even get basic copy. I had to go out and buy some copy for $5 at some secondary. It was hilarious. I went home and was watching it, and really the scene for me that absolutely unlocks it is the scene with Nicole and Tom, where she's talking about her fantasy about the sailor and saying how, you know, they had been spending all afternoon talking about their future and making love and doing all those things. And she said, it was a really precious afternoon between us. And she said, and I felt very, very close to you. And we were talking about our future and our daughter. I think, yeah, their daughter and all that stuff. But she said, and this is the line, this is the line. She said, but at no point did the thoughts of a sailor ever leave my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Now that is heavy. I mean,
yeah.
You think, you know, a lot of people were saying, well, you know, we don't understand what the big deal of the film was because, you know, no sex really happened. Neither one of them was unfaithful and, you know, that's no big deal. And it didn't make sense. They did it in modern day. They should have done it in 1920s for there to be no adultery going on and all that stuff. But when you listen to that line,
yeah.
That line is just huge.
I think you're right, yeah. And plus, just as a scene, it's pretty much the most hypnotic scene I've ever witnessed in a film.
Yeah.
I felt completely in the zone that he was creating. I felt lost in that movie at that point, and the core was just phenomenal in that film.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me about your band before you go. It's terrific music. I've listened to some of it over the weekend. But give us a
Thank
taste
you
of
so much. Yeah,
a,
it's well, it's really my number one baby. I have to admit. I mean, you know, I write, produce. You know, the whole image of it is all me. You know, I am the sophisticated savage. And actually, Stanley heard the music as well, and he really liked it. I couldn't believe it. I mean, because he was asking me. He said, What are you doing here in England? And I said, well, you know, I've been working as a model. I'm also a musician. And he said, oh, you know, my daughter's a musician. I'd love to hear your music. I thought, really? You know, right in the middle of this huge film. But, you know, I did what he asked. I went home, put stuff on, I think it was a cassette at the time. I put about half hour worth of music on a cassette. Came back the next day, and he goes, oh, gosh, I love this song. And now what made you decide to use such and such for this, you know, and asking me questions about each song.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just floored at that point because, you know, and he said, I love your music. Your voice is fabulous. And, you know, coming from someone like that, I was really flattered.
You couldn't ask for better
I know. It's just fantastic. And I was just amazed that he took all that time out. You know, I mean, he took a half an hour out of his life looking at rushes and all that stuff to listen to my music.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of guy he was, you know. I think a lot of people don't realize what people think that he's an egotist, but he's not. He's an intellectual that likes to immerse himself in information. He just needs more information to take in, to to kind of feed his brain, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, getting back to my music. just really influenced by all the different styles that you can hear, lounge, exotica, early soul, blues, early rock and roll, you know, kind of a lot of things in that era of the late 50s, early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been singing, I don't know, 92.
Wow.
And I don't know, I just realized I had a talent for it, and just, I don't know, once I started, I couldn't stop. I'm addicted to it. I spend hours and hours and days and months and years in a studio. I just, you know, track the time, I love it. And in the same way, I think that Stanley loved having total control of his baby, film.
Yeah.
I love having total control of my music. It's just the ultimate artistic statement, really.
Yeah,
you know?
It's something that
your baby, it's your creation.
It's something that you have to do. You can't not write songs or perform songs.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. Well, and a lot of times when you have a creative, I don't know what you want to call it, epiphany, you know, you could be sitting there doing something as mundane as anything, and all of a sudden a song lyric will pop into your head, a melody will pop into your head, and you think, oh, gosh, well, better write that down. And usually 15 minutes later, you've pretty much vomited out an entire song.
That is exactly it. And I find that the more you have to think about it, the more labored and the song becomes, the kind of weaker the song is. It just has to kind of flow from you.
That's true.
Yeah.
And the songs that are the better songs on the album are the ones that did that very quickly.
Oh, yeah.
And there are other songs that we had to hash through again and again and again and again. And those are the ones I find more difficult to listen to because we've had to do it so many times.
Yeah.
Know?
So where can our listeners find your music?
You can find it on iTunes.
Okay.
Or iTunes UK or USA either. Or you can contact me via my website, sophisticatedsavage.com.
Okay.
Or julianedavis.com, either one. And I can send you a hard copy if you don't want to just, you know, download things off the internet.
Sounds great. Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight and sharing your thoughts and insights on your experience with Mr. Kubrick.
It was a pleasure. I always like talking about it. It's great.
Well,
I mean, it was a great experience, and I was lucky to have it, very lucky.
You're welcome back on anytime you'd like in the future.
Okay. Take care.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye now.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
It's Julian Davis, phenomenal talent, phenomenal performance in Eyes Wide Shut, a great part, a great way to start a career, wow. Before we have our next guest on, Larry Smith, he's calling from France, I believe. Aaron, give us a little primer on what we can expect from this box set. What films are involved and what are the highlights in terms of extras?
Well, the Stanley Kubrick box set, from what it seems to be, Warner Brothers is launching this more director-centered series, and then they call it the director series, and so one of the first ones is going to be Stanley Kubrick, and it's going to be 10 discs, 5 films, plus the great Stanley Kubrick documentary, A Life in Pictures.
Yeah.
And I believe Full Metal Jacket is the only one that's a single disc, and the other ones are going to be double disc special editions, and this is going to be the third time around that they've put out a kind of Kubrick collection, but it seems like finally Warner Brothers got it right. I remember back in 99, they rushed kind of a Kubrick box, and it just had the films and a trailer, and it had, you know, kind of also like Lolita and Strangelove, but there were a lot of problems with the aspect ratios, and it was only mono tracks, and then I think a couple of years, 2 years later, 2001, they sort of rectified the aspect ratios, and they added Eyes Wide Shut, but it was still no real bonus features, only that documentary. So finally here, I guess they've really been meticulous in working with the Kubrick estate. They have given these films 5.1 mixes. They're all in their proper aspect ratios, because as we all know, with the exception of 2001,
yeah,
Kubrick pretty much worked in the British Academy ratio, that 1.33, 1.66,
yeah,
1.78. So it's a very minimal widescreen letterboxing, but it is essential.
So what are we looking at? We're looking at 2001.
2001, Clockwork.
Yeah.
Shining, Full Metal Jacket, and Eyes Wide Shut. I think the big selling point, the two big selling points on the Eyes Wide Shut DVD is obviously the unrated version is going to be on there, but I think the other thing is a featurette entitled Stanley Kubrick, the unmade films, I believe is the title, or the not, you know, the lost films.
Yeah, and we will be discussing some of those films. You know, there's 12 years between Full Metal Jacket and Eyes Wide Shut. It wasn't that he wasn't working.
Right.
I mean, he was constantly investigating different sources of material.
If I know my Kubrick folklore, the three films that will probably show up in that documentary featurette will be obviously Napoleon and obviously AI, which did eventually get made posthumously, and his Holocaust film, Aryan Papers.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. And once again, that's something he just felt he couldn't do, and he thought Spielberg was better suited for it because then Schindler's List came out. And then,
right. So some of the extras include, we have Sidney Pollack commentary on Eyes Wide
Pollack
Shut.
Pollack and a film historian. All of them pretty much have at least a film historian commentator.
Yeah.
And then some actors, Gary Lockwood and Keir DeLay are in 2001. Adam Baldwin and D'Onofrio and Arlie Ermey on Full Metal Jacket.
Mm-hmm.
And Malcolm McDowell's on Clockwork. The two other, you know, obviously there are a lot of featurettes that are just about the film specific to the DVD, but there's a couple of interesting featurettes that I think are really going to be fascinating. One is called Look, Stanley Kubrick, and that seems to delve into his pre-film career when he was a photographer for Look magazine.
Yeah, we're going to get into that as well. We have our next guest is on the line, so let's get them up and going, and then we'll continue on this conversation at the top of the hour about what we can expect with the box set, and we'll discuss some of Kubrick's other films amongst ourselves. But we're really excited about this next guest. He worked as a chief electrician on Barry Lyndon and as a gaffer on The Shining, and he worked closely with Kubrick in designing the overall look and feel of Eyes Wide Shut as his lighting cameraman. Other films on which he's worked as cinematographer include Fear X, The Piano Player, and Red Dust, and incredible television events like Prime Suspect 6 and Elizabeth I. It is our great pleasure to welcome to the show Mr. Larry Smith. Mr. Smith, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here. How are you?
Hi, how are you, sir? Thank you so much for joining us on the show tonight.
No, my pleasure.
We've been so excited about speaking with you. Now, you worked with Kubrick on three pictures, like I just mentioned, starting with Barry Lyndon in 75, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
So what expectations did you have of the man prior to meeting and working with him, and how did he surprise you?
Well, I first met him in 74, which was when I started to work on Barry Lyndon.
Mm-hmm.
I just went there for a week. They'd been shooting in Ireland, and he'd come back from Ireland, and they were resetting up in the south of England.
Yeah.
And in one of the stately homes that we shot in. And I was really only there for a few days, really, just to help out. You know, it was a rush that he had come back. Nobody really knew he was back, and they had to get the sets ready and locations ready, etc. And so for me, it was just really a filling few days, and I didn't really know that much about him in those days. I mean, I knew he was a big, I knew he was a big director. He was a big name. But I didn't really know that much about him until, you know, a few weeks into working on Barry Lyndon.
Yeah. He had we spoke to this a little earlier, but the way he was able to make films, the freedom he had, it was unprecedented, wasn't it, his relationship with Warner Brothers?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's any accident if you chart Stanley's career from the... from the very early days. I think that I don't think it was necessarily premeditated, the working environment that he created for himself, but certainly film after film, and certainly when he moved to England, I think he was always moving towards being comfortable in the environment that he worked in, and comfort for him was being able to do what he wanted when he wanted in a relatively small geographical area, which he achieved.
Yeah, observing him, and this might be a completely obvious question, but being close to him and working so closely with him on some of these films, what did you observe as some of the qualities that made him such a phenomenon as a filmmaker?
Well, the first thing I guess I noticed, because as I said, I didn't really know that much about him, was that, you know, he's a gentle soul, Stanley. He wasn't someone that really stamped his feet and shouted and screamed. Mm. But he had a presence, almost mystical presence, really. You know, when he would arrive on the set, I mean, certainly the first time I saw him, when he came to look at some of the locations that we'd been lighting, you just felt that there was that there was this presence, that he just sort of came in very kind of nonchalantly, but everybody was kind of sort of at attention, and looking and waiting for him to speak, waiting for him to, you know, say, you know, everyone was kind of slightly holding their breath in a way, in an extreme way, and that kind of surprised me a bit, and I kind of realized then very early on that he was highly respected by everybody around him.
Yeah, and he was so meticulous from what I've read, particularly in terms of the technical aspects of his films. I mean, the craft is always impeccable in everything he did. What was that collaboration like from a technical aspect with Mr. Kubrick?
Well, you're absolutely right what you say. I mean, you know, the term perfectionist has been used many times about Stanley, and it's certainly true the way he worked. I think Jan Harlan, his brother-in-law, once said, you know, the thing about Stanley is he looks under every stone.
Yeah.
And I would say yes, he does look under it, or he did look under every stone, and then he'd go and look again, in case he missed something. The fear of, in a way, of missing something. Did he let something go that he didn't really give it his full attention, and the time he would spend on anything really, not even away from movies, because I was lucky enough to spend a lot of time with him in between movies. Mm. So you get to know, you know, not necessarily Stanley Kubrick the director, but more Stanley Kubrick the man, and almost, so I could say, possibly friend in a way.
Yeah.
And everything that he did, from, you know, whether it was working on a script, whether it was, you know, buying a telephone or, you know, a typewriter or pens or paper, whatever, it was, you know, there was a tremendous amount of research that went into every little detail.
Yeah. Yeah, I recall reading accounts of that. He was, his endless curiosity and how he would investigate every, he was fascinated by so much. And that's part of what made him such a fantastic filmmaker, is that his fascination with every aspect of everything that he investigated. I want to talk to you a little bit about The Shining, because obviously one of our great classic films of the past 27 years. Looking at Vivian Kubrick's documentary on the making of The Shining, it's really an unprecedented look inside his working process. And that's included in this special DVD set out on Tuesday. But it seemed like there were moments of great tension during that shoot. Was that a tense set?
No, I wouldn't say so. I mean, I think that certainly some of the scenes in Vivian's film polarized that a little bit. And there were certainly, you know, periods when it was very cold, and, you know, and there was a lot of noise and a lot of smoke, in particular on that one of the scenes I think you're referring to. And, you know, tempers get a little bit frayed from time to time. Walkie-talkies don't work, or messages are not conveyed. And I think, you know, the tension builds. There were moments like there are on every movie, but generally speaking, I would say... not so much, really. I thought it was I thought it was a reasonably relaxed film to work on.
Yeah. What did you observe of how he works and collaborates with his actors? That's a very close, intimate collaboration, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, he's very happy to give direction. He's also very happy to see what actors can give back to him. You know, he'll happily go along with, you know, a certain amount of takes, and then if it's not right, he may then step in and give a little more direction. But I think generally speaking, Stanley, for the most part, I mean, on that film in particular with Jack, I mean, you know, what direction do you give Jack Nicholson in a way? You know, I mean, Jack would just, you know, do it one way, do it another way. Stanley would say, try it another way. But, you know, it's very difficult to say to Jack, you know, that was good or that's not. So, but Jack always felt, I think Jack always felt from memory anyway, that he always felt his second or third take was, you know, probably the take that he would go for film after film. I seem to remember him saying that to me once, but still, we would still do 50 or 60 maybe on certain of the takes. So, but Jack was very happy to do it a different way.
Right.
But, you know, at the end of the day, it was Stanley's call. If he wanted it a certain way, when he was happy with it, he walked away from it. But he would never walk away from it until he was happy.
Yeah, and what was he looking for when he... I know that some he did... Some scenes he would shoot in... I read about Eyes Wide Shut. Some scenes he would shoot in 2 hours. Some scenes would take 3 weeks. But when he didn't get what he wanted and he was... using all of those takes, what quality was he looking for? Was he just looking for something to surprise him?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, I think Stanley said many times, really, really is good, but interesting is better. You know, and I think that, I think sometimes he didn't know what he was looking for, I'm sure, and sometimes he wouldn't know for a day or two, and sometimes, you know, he might shoot a scene and then look at it again in 3 or 4 weeks' time and think, you know what, that doesn't work. Doesn't work the way I wanted it, and he'd go back and do it. So I think, you know, what he was trying to achieve was obviously always the best possible take with all of the elements working all of the time. But sometimes there's so many elements in a scene that you don't always see them at that time. And you know, with hindsight, you can look back and say, well, I wish I'd have done this, I wish I'd have done that. A lot of directors obviously have to go with, you know, whatever they shot on the day. And Stanley had obviously this amazing way of working where he could look at something and go back and reshoot it, and did quite often.
Well, how did he approach you when it came time for Eyes Wide Shut? Was it just as simple as he wanted you to be his cinematographer, lighting cameraman for that piece?
Well, what had happened was about because after The Shining, I kind of went off and pursued other areas, you know, and so I didn't, you know, that was the point I kind of lost contact with him for maybe 2 or 3 years. I'd get, you know, a Christmas card or whatever, but and then just when he was, I think he was in research with Aryan Papers, certainly with AI anyway, he just called me one day out of the blue, because I used to live for some time quite close to him, and oddly enough, all the time I lived there, I never... One of the times I saw least, one of the periods in my life where I saw sort of least amounts of time with him.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
He just called me one day and said, you know, I don't know, he just called me and we just started talking about something. And I seem to recall the conversation went on for about 4 hours, which seemed like 5 minutes at the time. But I mean, it was afterwards I put the phone in and I realized it was late evening. And he said, "Can you come up to the house? What's new? What's new in lighting? What's?" I said, "Well, there's a few little things that have come out." He said, "Come up, bring them up. Why don't you bring them up and show them to me?" And I went up, and we were in the projection room in his theatre at his house in St Albans, and we were just talking. Really, I showed him these lights. I don't think he was that interested in these lights. No, they were interested in nice little things, but we just talked really about movies and about, you know, what you've been doing, how are you? I hear you're a cameraman now, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this went on late into the evening. We had some supper, sandwich or something, I seem to recall. And I went away. And then a sort of period of time went by. He didn't make Aryan Papers. He, I guess at this stage, was thinking about Eyes Wide Shut.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just got a call from Stanley again, which was a very long conversation. I was in my office, and we were just talking about... I seem to remember we were talking about a couple of movies that had come out at that time, which we talked about. And he was infused in about one of them. And we that was it. We spoke before. No talk about doing Eyes Wide Shut or anything else. He said, "Let's keep in touch."
Mm-hmm.
I said, yeah, fine. And then another 2 or 3 months went past, and he called me up, and he said, what are you doing? I remember I'd just gone to my office, and I said, well, I'm just going to the gym. And he said, the gym? What are you going to the gym for? I said, well, you know, he said, can you come over to the house? So I said, yeah, sure. So I went over to the house, and he, by this time, wasn't, he used to drive himself a lot in the early days when I knew him, and this time he wasn't driving himself so much, but this day, he said, come in the car, I want to take you somewhere. And he took me to a house, which is about 45 minutes drive from his house, and asked me about an exterior scene. And he said, well, how would you do this at night? You know, how would you light this at night? And I said to him what I would do and talk. We get in the car, we come back, we have a cup of coffee, I go home. Still no talk about that. And about another 2 or 3 weeks, I think, went past, and he called me up and said, would you be interested in Eyes Wide Shut?
Yeah.
And I sort of, in a way, it wasn't unexpected, oddly enough, because I kind of felt this was probably coming. So it wasn't a huge shock to me, but I just, having worked for Stanley on 2 films, on Barry Lyndon and The Shining, and knowing really what's required,
yeah,
in terms of body and soul, I didn't say yes immediately, which a lot of people find hard to understand. But I didn't say yes because I had my own career, and I was working as a DOP, and I had a company which I was running as well, and I just thought I don't know how difficult this would be.
Yeah.
So I went away, and I said I'd speak to him in a couple of days, and I thought about it long and hard, and then I kind of came back, and then I went down to see him, and we talked some more, and then I went away on holiday. I actually came to France on holiday, and thought about it some more, and then we spoke again, and then in the end I said, you know, that I would do it. It was a fairly long, drawn-out process, and it had nothing to do with money, and it had nothing to do with it. It was just about lifestyle and the commitment, really.
A major time commitment, the two. Mm.
And of course, I knew, having worked with Stanley on 2 movies. I mean, I just know the way he works. I know how long things take,
mm-hmm.
And I was coming from it. I was educated in the Kubrick way of working, which was why it took me so long, really, to say yes.
Yeah, I completely understand where you're coming from on that. We have a couple of questions concerning the look of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And Aaron, you wanted to ask something in particular, didn't you, concerning the look?
Yeah, I wanted to ask, because obviously one of the most interesting lighted scenes is the big Cruz Kidman bedroom scene where she confesses. And it seems as if Kubrick was going for natural lighting, in that he, you know, if you're in the family room and you got the lamps on and the overhead light on, this is the way it should look. Or in the bedroom, you got the lamps on and overhead light, this is the way it should look. It's just that it's so rare that bedrooms or family rooms or living rooms have ever looked that way in movies, that it looked, you know, like they were using extra wattage bulbs in the lamps and so forth. I mean, because there's even a point when Nicole Kidman is standing in the doorway and you can see what she's wearing, but you all can see the outline of her panties and her bra, and it's all because of the lighting. And so I was wondering what was his goal or what was his ambition for the lighting, particularly in like those interiors, whether it's the apartment or Sidney Pollack's party scene.
Yeah.
And because also, I would guess that Kubrick purposely picked the Christmas season for the setting, also because it gave him interesting lighting choices. So that's kind of my curiosity. And what was his process?
Yeah, no, I think so. I mean, I think that certainly when I first read the script, I immediately, it's very interesting when you get a script to read. You know, for me, it's either on the first couple of pages or it's not there. And it was very strange when you read the first page and it was actually set at Christmas and all that, and I don't know, it gives you a good feeling as a director of photography about the possibilities. So we you know, obviously when we were testing this and looking at various ways of doing the scenes, you know, the practical lighting. I mean, what you have to understand about the way Stanley worked was that he always wanted total freedom to move around the set, and he, since The Shining, he used a lot of Steadicam.
Right.
And Steadicam leads itself to being at, to being able to do 360 degrees. Well, you can't do that with a lot of conventional film lights, because at some stage you're going to be looking at them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a way of devising a system where you get a very natural look by using natural sources, just slightly boosted natural sources, but not hugely, but just basically. So you could use the actual, lights on the set, which would be the inferior lights in a bedroom or in a kitchen or whatever, to give you an exposure, to give the camera flexibility to move around,
mm-hmm.
and just bring in the odd thing here and there, on maybe on a close-up, or light through the windows, which is, at the end of the day, and I've said this many times, if you think back to, the way the great painters worked, they had two sources of light. They had daylight or they had candlelight. And what's changed, apart from now we use electric light instead of candlelight, the window lights are still the window lights. You still get daylight or sunlight or moonlight or whatever. So it's a very natural way of working if you actually think about it. The problem has been, obviously, has been able to get an exposure, working at those kind of levels. And, of course, with modern film stocks and fast lenses, and also the way we shot that movie, because we force-developed everything two stops as well.
Yeah,
which gave us the opportunity to use low-level light sources, but still get a reasonable stop in terms of focus.
Yeah, and didn't you also you were investigating different film stock to use, and the one you decided upon was a discontinued.
Well, it was just being discontinued. It was a stock. I mean, if you look at the history of Stanley's movies, the
yeah.
periods of time in between, especially the last, say, two or three, and I think the period of time between Full Metal Jacket and Eyes Wide Shut was the longest period that
yeah,
he ever went between making movies. And, in that 7 or 8 or 9 year period, a lot of things change. And Stanley doesn't work with film every day of his life. He's developing scripts, or he's working on some of his other movies. So the technical aspects, he wouldn't necessarily have been able to experience. And 5298, as I believe it was then, was a stock that I'd been using a lot anyway. And it was a stock that I personally liked. I didn't actually know it was being discontinued at that time. It wasn't until we decided on that stock, having
yeah.
tested other stocks that were out, that we realized this was the best stock that was on the market for force developing, because the other modern stocks of the same ISA speed were designed more for the modern era of post-production, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
and the over and under exposure range on that. Whereas 5298 wasn't quite like that, and it didn't give you too many biases when you pushed it.
Mm-hmm.
So, just by default, we ended up using that. It just happened that they were discontinued it, and they were trying to push a new stock, the Vision stock, and we wanted a lot of it, and there wasn't a lot of it around. I don't think there was too much in America. There was some in Europe, but they guaranteed that we would get it, and they made some more for us, I think.
Yeah, just two more quick questions for you, and then we'll let you go. But the film seems to be showered in deep reds and blues. Was there a discussion thematically on how these colors fit into the story?
No, not really. I mean, I think that basically what happened, if you take, for example, the opening scene in the movie,
mm-hmm.
Which is the Tom and Nicole getting ready in the apartment,
right,
and in the toilet scene. It was something that evolved. I mean, it's something that if you see some of my work, I quite like those deep blues and warm interiors. And I think it was really a question of, let's test it. What should we do? Well, let's have a look at this, and then we do something. We put some blue in the window, and it's an exaggerated blue, for example. I mean,
yeah.
Moonlight is never that blue. I mean, it's really neutral,
mm.
but that blue was so, it was almost theatrical.
Yeah.
And that really just developed by us looking at it, and we were saying, well, that's a bit blue. I might have said, that's a bit blue. And so I said, well, you know, it's a bit blue, but it's interesting. Why don't
yeah.
we just, you know, so it goes back to the realism thing, you know, what's real and what's interesting.
It is
not real, but it's interesting.
Yeah, exactly, and it's a gorgeous-looking movie. Just watching it again recently, it has a fantastic look. Did you get a sense that he was happy with the finished film?
Well, you've got to remember, there's about at least a year in between me finishing on the project and Stanley finishing the cut. Maybe a little bit longer than that, actually. So I didn't see. I was working, so I never really got the chance to discuss with him, you know, the final cut, because as you know, he died shortly afterwards,
yeah.
and I hadn't spoken to him in that intervening time. But knowing Stanley, if he spent that amount of time and then he was prepared to show it to the Warner's people and Tom and Nicole in New York, he wouldn't have shown it if he wasn't happy with it.
Yeah.
That I'm convinced of.
Yeah.
And there is, you know, there's always conjecture about, did he finish it? You know, he finished it. That I'm sure of.
Yeah. And it is one of my favorite Kubrick films. I think it is benefiting from the passage of time as well, because with any Kubrick film, it benefits from repeat viewings.
Mm.
We were discussing it earlier. You can't necessarily get all there is to a Kubrick film just from a single viewing.
No.
Yeah, and it's amazing work, and we're so honored to have you on our show tonight and share your thoughts about Mr. Kubrick and your own work on the film, and we can't thank you enough.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
That's Larry Smith, Mr. Kubrick's lighting cameraman on Eyes Wide Shut. A great, great, insightful interview.
That was. I mean, you really couldn't ask for it. I mean, actually, the two interviews we had, I mean, I think that added a lot more insight than I've gotten from a lot of interviews and a lot of books over the years.
Yeah. We're going to go a little bit over tonight because we wanted to take some time out to discuss kind of Kubrick's legacy and what it means to each of us amongst ourselves. If you're listening live, it'll cut off in about 3 minutes. But
that's bollocks.
Yeah, well, we didn't plan on it. We could have scheduled a longer time.
No, that's all right. It's not your fault.
Blog Talk Radio is great to us, and we appreciate all the promotion and all the help.
We love them.
Yeah, they're terrific. But you can listen to what you miss on the live feed through playback. So just come back to us. It'll be about an hour or so when this episode will upload in its entirety. And you can listen to us rant and rave about the Kubrick's resume. We're just going to talk for another 15 or so extra minutes here. But I just want to thank Tiffany Littleton for our great opening announcement, as always, and let you guys know, on Wednesday evening, we have a first hour dedicated to the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre in honor of Halloween, which I personally find, you know, The Shining is a classic horror film in a lot of people's minds, and Chainsaw is that for me. It's the creme de la creme.
Yeah, it doesn't get any better than that. Actually, one of our listeners on Fatally Yours, she considers that to be one of the greatest horror movies ever made, and I have to say I agree.
Yeah, it definitely ruined my life forever. So it wrecked my psyche. So we have Daniel Pearl, who was the cinematographer on the original and the first remake, the Jessica Biel film, and you couldn't ask for two different looks. He's on, and we also have David Gregory, the documentarian that made The Shocking Truth, which is the definitive documentary.
That's going to be an awesome show.
And we also have the star of Saw 4, because every October they come out with a new Saw, and we can't overlook.
And as the 5 and 6 are being written as we speak.
They're going to be made concurrently, yeah.
Yeah.
They're being written, yeah. Oh, wait, they just were finished written.
No, I mean, it's incredible. This franchise is just skyrocketing.
And then we also have, on the following Sunday, we have another great show, and I don't have the details in front of me. We have so many guests coming on, it's easy to get sidetracked, but I know that we have an author of Save the Cat Goes to the Movies, which is the definitive new book on screenwriting, and I'm reading it, and it's very good. Blake Snyder, the author of that book, will be joining us on Halloween night with A. Kitman Ho, the longtime producer of Oliver Stone, who did Platoon, and Born on the Fourth, JFK, The Doors, Heaven and Earth. He produced all those films for Oliver Stone, and his new film, his new producing effort, is Reservation Road with Joaquin Phoenix, and I love saying the name, Joaquin Phoenix, and Mark Ruffalo, and he'll be on Halloween night. So we got some great shows lined up. Now let's get the Kubrick thing started. Aaron, now did you miss any of the features? Did you have any other features to spotlight on that disc set?
What I think is going to be most fascinating when I get my hands on the box is obviously there's going to be featurettes pertaining to specific titles.
Mm.
But I think the featurettes that I'm most looking forward to are the ones that are kind of slight offshoots. I mentioned the Lost Films of Kubrick featurette, obviously the Look Stanley Kubrick featurette, which it seems to going to be looking at when he was a photographer, and I think that's going to be very interesting. And the other one that I'm also curious about, because Kubrick didn't talk about it obviously that much, is the early films of Stanley Kubrick featurette, and I'm assuming these are going to be particularly on Fear and Desire.
That's an important one, and Killer's Kiss too.
Killer's Kiss, and so those two particular. So I'm kind of curious. Maybe we'll finally see a couple of clips for those, just to just so people can now actually see what all the talk is about. And also, I will say the most interesting featurette pertaining to one of the films is probably going to be on the 2001 disc, which is, I believe it's entitled Predicting the Future, which kind of is going to go through and see how much did 2001 get right and what did it get wrong and so forth. And I think that's going to be kind of a lot of fun. And the last featurette that I'm really looking excited for, I'm assuming it's not a text-based featurette, I'm assuming it's the actual clip, is Kubrick's DGA acceptance speech.
Yeah, in 1998, a year before he died, right?
Yeah, so I think that's going to be quite...
that'll be wonderful
yeah.
to watch.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
So, yeah, so I just think this box set is pretty spectacular. I mean, and that the documentary on Kubrick, it's like 2.5 hours almost, the Stanley Kubrick, A Life in Pictures.
It's a great documentary.
Produced by Jan Harlan, who was his brother-in-law.
And it truly is one of the best authorized documentaries on an artist that really has come along. I mean, pretty much everyone you can think of gets interviewed, and it's very candid. They don't hold back. They say...
Yeah, and
it
really gives you a sense of where he came from. And Jerry, you were going to tell us some of his background that we haven't covered so far.
Well, I was going to tell you some of his background, but I think it's really important to actually start out at the end. I got a phone call March 7th, 1999, when he died.
Yeah.
My brother called me up. This must have been 6 or 7 in the morning. We had all been going through a pretty rough patch in 1999, but he called me and he just said, Kubrick, dead, and hung up. It's very important that of all the people, my oldest brother Michael called me because he was the one who probably threw his name around the house a lot in the 70s and 80s. He took me to see 2001 numerous times in the theaters, countless re-releases, told me about Dr. Strangelove, The Shining, Clockwork Orange. I had been exposed to a lot of these films before there was even a such thing as home video.
Yeah.
I knew about them through images and books.
Yeah.
And, you know, Kubrick's name was, I wouldn't say that, he was kind of like almost a Kaiser Salse, if you will. His name is always thrown around.
Yeah.
And he was larger than life. He really was. And, you know, he was a photographer for Look magazine. And that's where he starts out, and it's, you know, he was a great photographer. He was very inspired by Max Ophuls' fluid style. This would inform his later work.
Yeah.
He made documentaries that were very well received. And then he made a movie, his first narrative movie, Fear and Desire. I've never seen this movie. I've read about it over the last decade. And you hear about it in documentaries, especially this documentary coming out with the box set. It predates Paths of Glory and Full Metal Jacket. It's a film about a fictional war, soldiers behind enemy lines, but the impression I'm under from what I've read is that Kubrick early on using Paths of Glory, but really this film, the insanity of war, the pointlessness of it.
Yeah.
And he really said this all in the first film, really, and the same is true, I guess, with Lolita. His views on sex really hadn't changed between Lolita and Eyes Wide Shut. That's not a that's not a criticism of Eyes Wide Shut. It's just saying that he was very consistent in his views.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that I have to say about Kubrick that is something that has me, he was a horrible student. Horrible.
When he was in school, he was horrible.
Yeah, he was an awful student. He had no hopes of higher education. And, you know, folks, for someone who didn't do well in school, he's a legend.
That's why he's an inspiration to all of us.
Yeah, he is. For me especially. You don't get any more inspirational than that. But his early work, and it's important to also talk about The Killing with Sterling Hayden, because that is really, two major films are influenced by that. The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, but also more importantly, Reservoir Dogs.
Mm-hmm.
You can't watch Reservoir Dogs and not see The Killing.
Yeah.
Whether Tarantino will own up to it or not, it's there.
And wasn't that, it was Paths of Glory that featured Kirk Douglas.
It is Paths of Glory that features Kirk Douglas, and if it's, you know, let's talk about Spartacus for a second. The year I finally saw 2001 in the theater was in the fifth grade. That was 1981. Spartacus was on that Easter Sunday. Now, Kubrick does not consider Spartacus his film because he was hired after Anthony Mann was fired by the studio. Actually, he was working on One Eye Jax at the time, and he claims Brando, later on he would claim Brando forced him out so Brando could direct it.
Yeah.
You can only imagine the 6 months they worked together. I would love to have video footage of that. that would have been insane.
Yeah.
But Spartacus is a superb film.
Right.
Yeah, I don't care what Kubrick says or what people... Spartacus is an excellent film. It's one of Douglas's finest roles outside of Detective Story and Paths of Glory. And there are a lot of Kubrick touches in there. He uses a lot of actors that he likes. And
For someone coming in late, I mean, past the due date and coming in late into a film, he does a remarkable job of whether, believes it or not or admits it or not, he does a remarkable job of really bringing Spartacus together and truly making it his own or as much as his own that can be said for a studio film where he's having to, you know, take notes, basically.
Well, exactly.
Plus, as an enormous film, and he was brought on at Kurt Douglas's request.
Yeah, I mean,
because
he really wanted
it.
I don't think they got along after that. I think the production soiled them. I mean,
well,
I think the production so much that, because he moves to England after this.
Yeah, but such a staggeringly large production, particularly for that time period.
Oh, yeah.
The way you had to make films then. It's a funny story about Spartacus, but I'd like to tell. Tony Curtis always told it. There's a big scene in a Colosseum or something, and there's hundreds and hundreds of extras, and then they're flooding the aisles, the rows in the Colosseum. He's filming the crowd reaction to something, and he pinpoints one person up there that isn't reacting the way he wants it out of the sea of people, and he says, "No, you need to wave your arms more." And he does another take, and the guy doesn't do it still. And he says, "You in the back." And he pinpoints him and says, "Wave your arms more and be more animated," and still nothing. And so this goes on countless takes. And finally, he sends somebody up there to check on him. And so they walk all the way up those steps, all the way, like a football stadium. Like, it takes forever to get to the very top. And you see him, and then he walks all the way back down, like takes 15 minutes to make that trip. And he says, "Stanley, that's a dummy." I always thought that was a great story.
That's a great one.
Yeah. So anyway, but I can understand why he kind of felt like disowning Spartacus, especially someone who enjoyed such control of his own.
Oh, absolutely. It makes sense later on.
And as a footnote, as we all, because we just love plugging him, Criterion Spartacus, special edition is truly an early highlight from the Criterion DVD days.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it is, definitely.
Yeah.
One of their great jobs.
So let's talk 2001. 2001 obviously was a major leap in the history of cinema and much less his career. And just the films that it inspired. I mean, we wouldn't have movies like Star Wars or Close Encounters without it. But even more so, it's a movie of ideas, which most films are not. And all of Kubrick's films were. That's what made him such a challenging filmmaker. But Chris, what are your thoughts on the first time that you saw 2001 and how it holds up for you now?
Well, the first time I saw it, I think I was probably about 12, first time I saw it, and I was getting into movies, but obviously I'd never seen anything like that before, and someone, an adult sort of movie mentor of mine, recommended that I watch it. And so as a 12-year-old, my reaction as soon as it was over was I was angry. I didn't understand, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I felt like I wasn't smart enough to get it. It made me...
You shouldn't feel that way, though.
Well, I was 12.
Yeah, but because Arthur C. Clarke and Kubrick even said they didn't know what the ending meant.
Well, obviously, I know that now.
Yeah.
But as a 12-year-old, you know, I didn't... There was no internet. I couldn't get on the internet and find out what the hell it meant.
Yeah.
I couldn't...
I miss those days.
We're consoling a wounded 12-year-old.
I know. I miss the pre-internet days.
But I've watched it, you know, obviously, probably 20 times since then, and I like it more and more every time I watch it because I don't necessarily understand it, because it doesn't give you exact answers. That's what's so great about it.
Yes.
It's one of the most intelligent movies ever made, and there's very little said, and very little actually happens on screen, but it's all very beautiful, and it all unfolds in this real slow burn kind of way, unlike any other movie that's ever been made.
Yeah.
So that's why I continue to watch it about once a year.
You can't get bored of it.
Yeah.
It's funny to note a couple of things that just, I think in this past or last week's Answer Man column by Roger Ebert, someone suggested, don't you think it's a good idea that it's a no-brainer that Warner Brothers should probably be exhibiting this film next year when the movie turns 40 years old? Mm. And Ebert says, it seems inevitable. I haven't heard anything, but it seems inevitable that 2001 should be re-released theatrically. And so that'll be kind of interesting if that does happen, even if it's just a limited top 20 market thing, that it top 20 market release, that is something that...
Also odd for Kubrick, because that's the one movie he shot, I think he shot 70mm.
70mm,
yeah,
that
mm-hmm.
Cinerama style, that's just pretty remarkable.
Begging for a theatrical.
I will say this, even though this is not related to Kubrick, I will stand up and say, on its own as a film and as an entertainment from an artifact from 1980s, particularly the pop pinnacle year of 1984, that 2010 is not a bad movie and holds up, is actually fairly good on its own terms.
Yeah.
So I just want to do a slight defense of 2010, because I know that's considered sacrilege by a lot of people.
No, it's not. I mean, it's based on a decent book by Arthur C. Clarke, mm-hmm. and it's really not. You would never try to top Kubrick.
And you can't.
Can't. I think Peter Himes knew that.
Yeah, and Peter Himes and Kubrick actually spoke, and Kubrick gave him his blessing. And
Roy Scheider actually gives a fine, very layered, everyman Americana performance in 2010.
Right. Well,
don't have any beef with that film, really, so...
Yeah. Clockwork Orange. That was his next film up, wasn't it?
The first punk film. The first cinematic punk. The first punk film. It even predates John Waters by a year of, you know, Pink Flamingos. One of the critics that we've talked about, Owen Lieberman of Entertainment Weekly, who I've interviewed and I've talked to, he's pretty much gone on record saying that's the first cinematic punk in movies.
True.
A role earmarked for, if Owen is correct, earmarked for Mick Jagger. Which would have been a totally different movie.
Very controversial.
It would have been, yeah.
A very controversial film for him, and he had run into to censorship issues
in England
on Lolita previously, but it really came to a head in Clockwork Orange, so much so that he pulled it from release in England.
Yeah.
And as soon as he pulled it from release, the criticism stopped. I think it was a question of, you remember the Natural Born Killers.
It's interesting you bring up Natural Born Killers.
Yeah, Clockwork predated it by 30 some odd years, and really spoke strongly of that kind of society that we're towards.
I saw, when I went to go see Natural Born Killers, I guess that weekend it came out, I think I went to go see it the Monday after it came out, my best friend Dave Hardiman, and then when I got home that night I watched Clockwork Orange, was on Cinemax, and it was just like, wow, God, this movie holds up so well.
Yeah.
I mean, and it still holds up well. God, I used to wear these T-shirts. I had tons of Clockwork Orange T-shirts in high school.
Well, you were one of those kids, huh?
Oh, I was definitely one of those kids. That film, when I found that on home video, that was 1986 or 87. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And we had, I guess we rented it in 84, but I really got into it in more in high school than junior high, and it was just like, wow.
And it's just a remarkable, and it's still, it's amazingly enough, the film has not dated, if anything. Like a movie like Network, it looks better as years go on.
Well, I think Network holds up well, but I think all of Kubrick's films hold up surprisingly well.
Yeah. Do we have thoughts on Barry Lyndon?
I will defend Barry Lyndon. I understand people's, you know, that's the one they don't talk about, and it is long. It's 3 hours, and it's a period piece. But it has a very wicked sense of humor. The humor comes in just the casting of Ryan O'Neal as a jerk. I mean, if you know...
He wasn't even acting.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say that, but if you know anything about Ryan O'Neal, you know Kubrick was very devious in casting him in that role.
Right.
It's a very simple story, but it's beautifully told. I will say two things. Obviously, for trivia fans, one of the key scenes from Barry Lyndon where Ryan O'Neal and Marissa, I forget her last name, how to pronounce it, where they meet, I think, in this intermission of a play, is referenced in Rushmore.
Mm-hmm.
When at the end, when Bill Murray and Olivia Williams kind of reconcile, sort of, during the intermission of Mac's Vietnam epic.
Yeah.
And that's a visual reference.
Yeah, that was on just recently, too.
To Barry Lyndon. And the other thing I would like to say, and that I think Barry Lyndon represents Kubrick at that point taking his style and stretching it to the absolute limit of how far can he take an audience and test their patience and their constitution. Because
mm-hmm.
If anything, Barry Lyndon is more challenging of a film up to that point than 2001.
Yeah.
And to give a equivalent to what Barry Lyndon is doing, if you go to look at the Michael Mann's filmography, I would wager that Michael Mann's Heat is equivalent to Barry Lyndon, in where Heat, having done, you know, Thief and the TV shows and Manhunter, Michael Mann finally decided, let's see how far I can test an audience's patience and their willingness to stick with the story. And so I consider Heat to be Michael Mann's Barry Lyndon. But
I think Heat is
that's
a lot
an interesting
more.
That's an interesting analogy.
Yeah, I mean, I think Heat is a lot more explosive and has a lot more explosive audience moments. And
but if you think about it,
and you're talking about Pacino and De Niro as opposed to
Ryan O'Neal. But I understand the point Aaron's making. It's an interesting analogy. I've never heard that, so that's a good analogy.
Mm-hmm. And we were talking earlier about with Larry Smith about how he wanted to use as much natural light as possible in the old days on the candlelight. Barry Lyndon has shot in many sequences using only candlelight.
Yeah, I don't think candlemakers got as much money as they could. I don't think they ever have had such a great period as that.
Yeah,
I mean, Barry Lyndon, it was a no-brainer when that movie came out that it was going to win all the technical awards for cinematography and costume and so forth. I will say this, though, as an English major, that also the requirement of enjoying Barry Lyndon to a certain degree is how much Thackeray you can tolerate. So if you can't tolerate Thackeray that much, then you're really not going to be able to tolerate the film version of Thackeray.
Right.
Okay, we got real quick. Let's cover his last three films really quick. The Shining, Chris. How do you think that film holds up?
I think it holds up great. I know it's one of those movies people either have it in their top 10 greatest horror movies of all time or they hate it. And for me, I think it is probably my favorite horror movie of all time. You know, it's a classic ghost story. I think it's a pretty good adaptation of a Stephen King novel. They don't always come off exactly like they do in his books.
Yeah.
But I thought that this one, while different, was a pretty good adaptation of the novel and cinematically very original. I love Jack Nicholson in it. I think it's still very scary, and I think it's got some fantastic imagery in it. And I don't think anyone can go into certain hotels. Every time I go into some hotels or particularly creepy, and it always reminds me of that movie.
It's definitely better.
Bravo, I agree.
It's definitely better than the Tommyknockers and the Langoliers and all the other bad Kubrick.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that goes without saying. All the Mick Garris films.
Yeah, poor Mick Garris. He just got shit on in one sentence.
Stephen King actually told a story that he was called because there's a five-hour time difference, and so it was like 7 a.m. his time when he was called, and his wife said, he was in there shaving, and his wife said, some guy claiming to be Stanley Kubrick's on the phone. And he's like, okay, so he runs to the phone, he's still got shaving cream on his face, and he says hello, and Stanley doesn't even say hello. He says, aren't movies dealing with the supernatural, in essence, optimistic? And he's
That's
like,
classic Kubrick.
So I don't really know. What do you mean? And he says, well, because it presumes that there's life after death. Isn't that optimistic? And this was like 7 o'clock in the morning. He's still sleepy. He's getting the kids out. He's got shaving cream on his face. And he said that was Kubrick. You know, he'd call in the middle of the night with these questions. And you know, it was a horror genre film, but there was a lot of thought and ideas behind.
Well, I love the story that he called him like at 3 a.m. and the first thing Cooper got out of his mouth, Stephen King answered, like, so, do you believe in God?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure Stephen King probably said, not at 3 in the morning. But.
And King was thinking, probably, what is he doing with my book? But
Stanley Kubrick's the only guy capable of creeping out Stephen King.
That's just something right there. That's power.
Jerry, tell us about Full Metal Jacket, your take on that film.
My take on Full Metal Jacket is this. We went to, this is probably the first, besides 2001, the first time I saw one of his films in the theater, you know, when it actually comes out, and the first half of that film is downright terrifying. I don't care what you say, and it is two different movies in one.
Yeah.
And I know it's compared to Platoon, and later on that summer compared to Hamburger Hill, but it is a true Kubrick film. It just shows you the insanity and pointlessness of war.
Yeah.
But Jesus Christ, Arlie Emery scares the shit out of me to this day. He's scary. I don't care who you are.
It's a big performance.
He scared Stanley Kubrick. He wasn't going to cast Arlie Emery. He considered two other people for that part, and Arlie Emery had asked him flat out, said, these other guys aren't up to snuff, I'll do it, because he was the advisor on the movie.
Yes, right.
Stanley Kubrick said no. So Arlie Emery's reaction was, you know, immediately started yelling at him, stand up when I'm talking to you, and just berating him the way he would.
He invented that character.
Dude, that character still scares the shit out of me.
What isn't widely understood, and I only came to this realization about 2.5 years ago when I took an American novel course, is that as much as Full Metal Jacket is based on Gustav Hasford's book, The Short Timers, that only provides kind of, you could say, the broad plot outline, but really the film is an unofficial inspiration adaptation of Michael Hare's Dispatches.
That's a great book.
There's a lot in Dispatches, not just like incidences and snatches of, you know, dialogue and so forth that are all over Dispatches.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. It is.
Basically, Joker, Matthew Modine, is a stand-in for Michael Hare.
Yeah.
And the way
that's a very good point.
He observes it, and so that to me is what makes Full Metal Jacket an equal to a lot of the Vietnam films. You know,
the second generation Vietnam films, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. I will just say that as my dad, my dad was a veteran, and his favorite Vietnam film is actually, he likes them all. He just likes them because he just thinks there should be more of them. But you know, his is like Deer Hunter, and mine is actually Apocalypse.
Both of those are mine.
But, you know, and I love Platoon and Full Metal Jacket, and I remember my dad was like, well, where's the sweat, you know, and all the other stuff? I go, you got to kind of look at, and this is the way audiences need to look at Kubrick's Vietnam, and that he's going for not just Vietnam as specific, but also in a broad term, just, you know, urban warfare. So
mm-hmm.
He keeps it to a very minimal, you know, you got the trees, you got smoke, you got rubble. And that's kind of what he keeps it into. And the fact that there is no sweat, but you also need a point, there's really no shadows in Full Metal Jacket. There's no sunlight, and then there's no lack of sunlight. It's a very neutral, cold palette, and that's kind of what gives it a very stark reality of its own.
Yeah. Right.
And that brings us to Eyes Wide Shut, which I think, between Eyes Wide Shut and Clockwork, those are my two personal favorite Kubrick films. And I like Eyes Wide Shut because I think it was the expectations involved. Like I said at the very beginning of the show, there are all these salacious kind of expectations because it was clouded in such a veil of secrecy in its production. But I think it's interesting how it's about the jealousy involved in just thoughts and fantasies and not actions. There is no infidelity in the film. It is paranoid. I think there's so many little telling moments. The first scene in the movie, Nicole Kidman disrobes and she's shot nude. The very next time she's seen, she's wiping herself on the toilet. I mean, that's a story right there. I mean, it really is about how the kind of sheen has taken off a relationship or a marriage, and how he doesn't even look at her when he walks in the bathroom, and they communicate kind of like an auto robot or something. I think it's a fantastic looking movie. I think it's complicated and challenging, and one that I don't fully appreciate as much as I know I will years down the road when I've watched it even a few more times.
I actually had a friend.
You said it perfectly, Jamie.
Yeah, I had a friend who was in a film class. This was in high school, of all things. And he became friends with the teacher in high school, and I think it was when Eyes Wide Shut came out. It was right after that. And the teacher told him that he goes, that is actually probably the most accurate depiction of the day-to-day inner workings of marriage.
Yeah.
And that, you know, some days are very good, some days are kind of trying, you kind of do give and take, you know, some days, you know, it's never always, you know, 50-50. Some days the husband needs more attention than the wife, and the other day the wife needs more attention than the husband.
Yeah.
And he goes, it's this constant up and down. And he goes, and he believed, like, particularly in the first half, that Eyes Wide Shut was probably the best portrait of the inner workings of a marriage.
Yeah,
and it gets a lot right, I think.
Chris, what was your take on Eyes Wide Shut?
I love it. I think it's great. I don't think it's just. I mean, obviously, it's about a marriage, but I think it's applicable to the fears that most people have in their relationships. You know, you don't think that there's anything going wrong, and then all of a sudden, your worst fears are realized. Your significant other tells you, oh, "While I've never cheated on you, you're not completely satisfying me." You know? I think it captures that the terror and confusion and frustration that causes. Perfect.
Yeah. Well, it's been a great honor to do the show tonight and talk with you guys and bring on the guests and speak with them as well. We're going to close it out. We've gone over a half hour. And just thank you guys so much. And everybody out there listening on replay, we'll see you back here Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern. All right, guys?
All right.
Have fun.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Good night. Bye-bye.